Hey, you may not believe this, but I really do want to create a bunch of ringtones with stuff like this here on it. Give it out. Still know if we can do that rights wise. Because I get to do this, and then this. Then I get to say I went and took it to Stranger. Then I get to say, oh my gosh, it's still on me! I got Stranger stuff all over me!
We're actually making this up as we go along.
If there were easy solutions, Seattle probably would not have elected a woman mayor.
It is an act of war to invest in white supremacy and terrorism with this bunker.
So every so often, I like to go monitor the left just to see what the thinking is. I like to understand our opponents and enemies. I think it's fair to say at the Stranger, it's a mix of opponents and enemies. They're not the same thing. We start with this from Charles, do I say Modid or Maud? I don't know. He's a clever writer, but bizarre opinions. Why crossing the border is an act of heroism? Recognize that? It's my music for the Stranger. In fact, you know what, Young Tom? We got to have this turned into music for the Stranger when we go take a trip to the Stranger. You know what it is, right? Do you know what it is?
I do, yeah.
Yes, it's Star Spangled Banner backwards.
Right.
Yeah, because I think it fits this. So he writes, just Charles Medid, that he's describing people who enter the country illegally. And he says about these people, why are these people so dogged? Why would they go through these struggles? Is that what they do all day, where they ever come from? Is that all they do? Dream of breaking the laws? Dream of entering the U.S. illegally? This is sadly how many Americans see these immigrants. It's in their bones to break the law. But the detained people at SeaTac, those crossing the border now, those leaving their homes and families, they did so out of desperation. And this is a hard fact for many Americans to grasp. The decision to leave and cross a border on foot illegally is hard to make. Humans, for the most part, want to live and die where they were born. We're a sentimental animal. Crossing a border into the unknown demands a lot of courage. And if you're incapable of sensing the amount of love that's needed for a father or mother to travel across the countries with their child, you've never been in a situation where your love has been tested in any significant way. Charles, you are functionally unaware. Well, no, you are functionally illiterate in regards to how conservatives think. I have never met a conservative who doesn't recognize that's a risky trip, who doesn't recognize that people are coming here to get a better life, who doesn't recognize many people are doing it for their love or their kids. And here's the thing you don't get, Charles. The frustration is not particularly aimed at the illegal immigrants. The frustration is aimed at a government for 60 years who has screwed this up, and it's aimed at people like you. You don't want any rules, Charles, when it relates to things that you like abortion. You don't want any rules there, like smoking the stink weed. You don't want any rules there, but you want rules everywhere else about who we can hire, when we can have them work, how much we have to pay them. You don't want rules about what they have to produce. You don't want any rules like that. But you want open borders, and we need to admit that. That's the frustration. The frustration is also this, Charles, that we as a country are already giving more than any other country. We give more officially in foreign aid. We give more privately in foreign aid. We have taken on more displaced peoples. We're 5% of the world's population. We've taken in 20% of the displaced peoples. What folks are saying is, let's get a process where people stand in line, where there's a methodology to this. Then Charles, of course, gets down to this. It's racism, well, we know that. Lastly, for Trump and his believers, there's already too many brown people in the U.S. Never met anybody who said that, Charles, and this might freak you out. I hang out in conservative circles. Never had anybody say to me, come on. Well, no, actually, that's not true. I had a guy who became a big deal on Twitter and was kind of a big deal in activism for a while, took me out to dinner outside of Austin, Texas, and sat me down and said, you know what, I'm really concerned about the, there's too many Jews running our government, and I'm concerned about too many, he didn't say brown people, but too many ethnics. And I put my hand up at the dinner table and said, I'm going to stop you there. You and I are not going to see face-to-face on this at all. You're not going to hear me out? Nope. I'm done. Thanks. Good night. Well, you got to buy dinner. Fine. Charge the dinner to the room. Good night. I had him charge a dinner to the room, then I left. I didn't want to be around the guy. That's the one guy, Charles, I've met. And I can point to plenty of racism on your side. But here's the interesting point he makes. Charles Madid, do I say Madid? At the stranger. The GOP is not big to put actual crises on the ballot. They still need something to fix, something to solve, some crisis to run to. The Republicans blew trillions of public dollars on a war against a country that had nothing to do with 9/11. So he contends that the border crisis is made up, that you and I and that the GOP just makes this up. But he goes through the lists of crisis on the side of the left. So he says gun violence. All right. Well, that's completely overblown. Right. Because we know that most of that is suicides, and we get down to gang violence. But you don't want to talk about that. You want to talk about mall shootings or school shootings. You have one in 614 million chance in dying in those. So when you say gun violence, what you actually mean is not the gun violence that you can stop, like gang violence. Lots of domestic violence. Okay, again, it's not lots of domestic violence comparatively around the globe. We've got those challenges. But Republicans don't view that as a crisis of federal government. We view that as a police response and jailing people who should be jailed and putting people who are mentally ill behind bars and being tough on crime. But you don't want that. You say lots of underfunded schools as a crisis that the left has. No, we don't see underfunded schools. We see stupidly spent tax dollars. We see a Seattle school district that a couple years ago had an $890 million budget. $340 million went to the central office. That's what we see. We see union members and union leaders, so-called, getting a couple hundred grand. We see that, so we don't see underfunded schools. Lots of homeless people. Yep, we see that. And we see us building an environment to encourage not homeless people, but street people. So we recognize that as a crisis. Lots of racism. Well, on your side, we see a lot of that. And I'd be happy to go through the measures of it, such as, Charles, you didn't write a column decrying the Seattle Public Library put on an event. The thesis of the event was the problem with the world is white people, and conveniently the problem with white people is they're white. Police brutality is on the list of things he says that left has real crises. Well, again, factually, from a data-driven perspective, that's not much of a crisis. It's crisis for people who go through it, and it's a big government issue, right? Government should be responsive, but it's not a crisis in any numerical sense. And then eliminating climate change. Well, good news there, Chuck. You and I agree that should be eliminated. Good news. It's been eliminated because it was never driven by humans to begin with. See what you do when you take a call, when you go to the left? You go see what goes on the left, what's inside their heads. To boil it down, you and I are afraid of brown people, and we don't have any real challenges. We don't have any crises in our country that we're worried about as conservatives. So we just decide to go focus on the brown folks. There you go. Such deep thinking from the deep thinkers of the left. We'll come back on the Todd Herman Show on AM 770 KTTH coming up at 5:30. I'll take you through 16 or 17 reasons why I-16... 39. I do it right? I-1639 is unconstitutional. When we come back immediately in the Todd Herman Show, let's talk a little astroturfing. Astroturfing in the media and astroturfing in activism. And a bizarre article that contends the United States is in the top 10 most dangerous countries for women. Whole series of media reporting that there is a grassroots march coming up. Families belong together on June 30th. It's grassroots coming straight from the people. It has nothing to do with MoveOn.org or the Soros-funded Priorities USA or the Women's March or the Organizing for Action, which is using the Obama Turnout Database or the ACLU or the SEIU or Planned Parenthood. It has nothing to do with the fact that they are the ones who are funding it. Wait until you start to hear it reported as being grassroots. It's already being promoted in 17 Magazine and Teen Vogue. Teen Vogue, which, by the way, ran an article saying that if your boyfriend wants to have sex in a way that cannot procreate and is maybe painful to you, you should let him do it because he likes it. That's, yeah, Teen Vogue. Well, we shared that with you on the air. They're organizing this Families Belong Together or promoting it as these other groups are organizing it. And it'll be promoted as, oh, it's just risen up from the base. So the media starts it. They astroturf the idea, first starting with the fake photos. Not fake, but they came about from 2014. They get caught at that. They take a few days off. Then they come back and say, okay, let's ramp this back up. Now you have the teen media reporting on this. Oh, look, there's going to be marches. All of this is voter turnout. You know this. All of this is about getting political power. You know that. But let's watch the media, and it's coming up. Well, it'll be coming up this weekend. I'm curious to see our local media refer to this as astro or as truly grassroots. There's lots of ways to go out and astroturf something. That's astroturfing something in public. There's an astroturfing of people's brains that has gone on, and it's amazing. It's amazing to watch it in action. There is, let's see, CBS News, Newsweek, others are tweeting about and running stories on a Thomson Reuters Foundation study that determined, ready? The United States is one of the 10 most dangerous countries in the world to be a woman. This is being treated seriously. So what was the methodology here? Did they look at murder rates? Rates of rape per capita? Was it adjusted for populations? Was it adjusted because there were war zones going on or wars happening? Well, no, they didn't have to go to all that work. They asked people. No, they got a panel of experts together. Experts, I say, like academics and social commentators and journalists. But don't worry, there was a lot of them, about 500. 548 women's rights experts around the globe. Once again, academics, social commentators, and journalists. And they asked them, hey, what's the most dangerous countries for women? Now, the United States was not in the top 10 list when it was discussed things like healthcare, discrimination, human trafficking, dangerous cultural or religious practices. But it rated in the top 10, and the reason it made the list is it's the third worst country in the world for sexual violence and the sixth worst for non-sexual violence. Again, by experts who have rated the United States to be tied with Syria when it comes to violence against women. And in terms of combating sexual violence, the U.S. trails only India and the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're worse at combating sexual violence than the Republic of Congo, South Africa, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Mexico, Nigeria, Egypt, and Somalia, according to a panel of violence against women experts from academia, social commentators, and journalists globally. Does anybody believe any data could ever back this up? The answer is no. Astroturfing of the mind. Hollywood's in on this. There is apparently a TV show. And that TV show is about a group of mercenary women. They've named their group Jennifer. It's an AMC feminist series called Taking Up Arms. They have a plot line where women are going about murdering folks because it's their only recourse. In a June 25, episode 25, they murdered their first woman in this. Now, there's a woman you remember, Julian Margulies. She was from ER. Remember her? She was the troubled nurse pop or a pill popping nurse who was with George Clooney and then not with George Clooney and then with George Clooney. And then they moved to Seattle or Portland, which was actually Seattle in the show. The last shot was taken on Lake Washington. Her name is Julianna Margulies. She plays a media mogul named Kitty Montgomery, and she discusses her decision to publish Jennifer's manifesto because Jennifer, this group of terrorists who are killing mostly men because it's their only recourse, they're killing perverts, and they're killing people who are sexual harassers. It's their only recourse in the 10th most dangerous country in the world for women, their only recourse. She describes it.
Women have been angry for a long time. A long time. So is it really so surprising that after all the abuse they've taken, they are finally fighting back with deadly force instead of just words?
Well, and with guns, it would appear. The great equalizer, guns, it would appear that I'm told the left doesn't want women to have. Who tells me that? Well, the left. So there's lots of ways to astroturf. There's astroturfing the fake rising up on June 30th, which is being orchestrated by Soros organizations and the ACLU, but it will be reported as coming up from the base. There's the astroturfing of minds, which is telling people there's a war on women in the United States and pretending that it's deeply, deeply unsafe here for women in the United States. That's a form of astroturfing. Then there's astroturfing media. The clip I'm about to play for you, I'm supposed to do this. I'm supposed to be outraged, okay? I'm supposed to be furious that they're trying to relaunch the show Firing Line. You remember that with John McLaughlin? I was on that. Not was it McLaughlin's show? It was on one of his shows. No, it was on the McNeil Air NewsHour back when I was doing talk radio in Spokane, back when I did it for a living. So Margaret Hoover has relaunched William F. Buckley's. It was Buckley, Firing Line. And here's how they're doing it. This is the clip they want you to hear of her accusing Paul Ryan of being a racist. Oh, by the way, she's supposed to be Republican. She's supposed to be a Republican.
It's something that's plagued Republicans for decades now, right? Because when you hear the term work requirement, there are some Americans who hear a dog whistle. There are some Americans who, in their mind, go back to 1980 and they hear Ronald Reagan campaigning against welfare queens.
This show really was something special to so many people for such a long time. Big shoes to fill.
Big shoes to fill. I am not William F. Buckley Jr. Some people will breathe a sigh of relief.
No, no one will, because you're not even a credible journalist, Margaret Hoover. This is, see, again, astroturfing. You guys pretend that there's some form of deep racism in the GOP. You then turn and report on it. Then you ask people like Paul Ryan about the report that you created. This is another form of astroturfing of the mind that this lady's performing. Now, see, I'm supposed to be outraged. I'm supposed to go on a long soliloquy. I'm supposed to play William F. Buckley clips. And the whole reason they do that is they're trying to astroturf us into tuning into this thing. Best thing to do with this new front line is do what you're doing now. Ignore it. Ignore it. It's not meant for you. It's meant for liberals who want to pretend to be able to say, oh, look, even the conservative, even Margaret Hoover over there on the Firing Line, William F. Buckley show, she says Ryan's a racist. It proves it. Proves it. 10th most dangerous country in the world for women. All right. Todd Emmer Show will continue as promised. Coming up next, I will reveal 16 or 17 reasons why the I-1639, the Bloomberg, Nick Hanauer, Paul Allen, anti-Second Amendment, anti-self-defense initiative is unconstitutional. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen. We've promoted it throughout the show. Now we get down to the work. Won't be the most exciting work because I'm reading from an initiative. 17 or 18 ways I-1639 is unconstitutional in my expert judgment. It starts with this. Understand that our state has a single topic rule when it relates to initiatives. You remember that because Tim Iman, of course, has had initiatives kicked back for being beyond single topic. Well, as you read through this, you're going to hear that there is no such thing as a single topic and related to this initiative, I-1639. I think that the people who are running this initiative, getting paid money to promote it and do the signatures, I think they know they're screwing Allen and Bloomberg. Because even as this thing passes, now we know it's illegally written. The initiative apparently is illegally written in that it doesn't even contain the actual initiative people are signing, which makes it moot, even if they get enough signatures. So we start by examining the single topic rule. All right, here's a single topic. Enhanced background checks. Okay? That's what we're told this is about, right? Except it's not. Topic number one that makes this unconstitutional because we move past the single topic arena. It requires a firearm safety program. It will be mandatory if you decide to go or if a dealer is going to sell to you a semi-automatic, quote, assault rifle. You're going to have to go through a mandatory safety program that the state decides is good enough. And the purchaser will have to, or the purchaser will have to provide proof that you've done that through a recognized source. How long is that going to take? Well, they don't care. They hope it takes a long time. Number two, second reason it goes past the single topic scenario. It creates a gun ownership database. When you purchase a weapon, you're going to keep a description of the pistol or semi-automatic rifle, including the make, the model, the caliber, and the manufacturer's number if available at the time of applying for the purchase of a pistol or semi-automatic rifle, which is the beginning of course, a database. That's not the end of the database. It's the beginning. That's the second reason it goes past the single topic test. The third reason, I-1639 goes past the single topic test. Warnings. It creates a series of warnings, some of them warning you that you can get in trouble if you don't understand state rules, etc. And there'll be more warnings later. That's number three. Number four, reason why it goes past the single topic scenario. It creates new fees, brand new fees. Number six, it creates a waiting period. Number seven, it describes and mandates what they decide is secure gun storage. They describe that as putting in a locked box, etc. What they don't describe is when. When do you have to do that? Is this one of the magic initiatives where when the bad guys break down your door and start trying to drown your kid? Did you hear about this? Home invasion robbers broke into a house and started drowning a kid's water or face in water? Or the woman who shot in Virginia, who shot a guy who came all the way from New Zealand, apparently to rape her 14-year-old girl trying to break into her house. She shot him. Would she have had to say, hey, excuse me, I need to get my gun out of my safe? They don't describe that, but they do in item number seven, create another reason why this is unconstitutional, because now it's secure gun storage. Now, item number eight, forcing gun stores to sell safes or trigger locks. I have no problem with gun stores selling them. They should. If you have a gun, you should have a gun safe. And if you don't have a gun safe, you should have a trigger lock. But they're forcing it, and it's another item. Remember it started with background checks? Right? These aren't related to background checks at all. Some more warnings in item number nine. You may face criminal prosecution if you store or leave an unsecured firearm where a person who's prohibited from possessing firearms can and does obtain them. Number 10. This is the fun one. You'll love this. A signed application to purchase a pistol or semi-automatic so-called assault rifle shall constitute a waiver of confidentiality and written request that healthcare authorities, mental health institutions, and other healthcare facilities release to an inquiring court or law enforcement agency your information. Yep. It creates a new rule. You buy a gun, you don't have any healthcare privacy. Remember, single topic. We're up to topic number 10. Above background checks. They provide a waiver of liability for the government in topic number 11, which goes past the single topic rule of the initiative process in our state. Number 12, new fingerprinting for gun store employees. Number 13, new licensing fees. And number 14, another gun registration database. A true record in triplicate shall be made of every pistol or semi-automatic so-called assault rifle sold in a book kept for the purpose, the form of which may be prescribed by the director of licensing and shall be personally signed by the purchaser and the person effecting the sale, each in the presence of the other, and shall contain the date of sale, the caliber, make, model, and manufacturer's numbers of all weapons, the name, address, occupation, and place of birth of the purchaser, and a statement signed by the purchaser that he or she is not ineligible under state or federal laws to possess a firearm. It's a good little database for you. In triplicate, yeah, that'll last. That's going on a computer. You and I both know it. And the forms are going to be scanned, and you and I both know it. That's item number 14. On why this is unconstitutional, 14 items past the single topic limit. Of course, the new age limits. If you're 21, you can't carry a weapon with you. You can only defend yourself at home. And in that case, sounds like you need to take your gun out of a gun safe to do it. Number 16 creates new definitions for firearms. Number 17, new definitions for crimes. 17 items. And that's not counting the initial item of enhanced background checks. Someone explain to me how this initiative is a single topic. It's not. It's 18 topics, and that's being generous, because they could go line by line through this and show that these are unrelated topics. Now, if this gets to the Seattle Supreme Court, here's a warning, guys. You let this thing go, no one's going to follow it, and you're going to put the last nail in the coffin of any respect any gun owner or will have for your rules. All right, Todd Herman Show, come back and wrap up the day with a personal note.
Down on Main Street.
Welcome back to the Todd Herman Show. Thanks for sticking with us all day long. We do this every weekday, 3 to 6 p.m. Special note, I'm going to be in for the great Rush Limbaugh this coming Friday. Once again, getting to do this from Seattle. So thanks to Bo Snerdly for making the trip out here. I owe you two in a row, Bo. So next time up, I'll head out to New York and do it there if I'm honored to get to do it again. Never assume you get to do it again. Doing it one time was enough. Well, not enough, but a big enough honor. This will be time number 7. So I want to thank all of you for that. Because here's a fact. I get to go do this, but we're doing it together. And also understand something, that they're kind enough at EIB to let me talk a little bit about what goes on in Seattle, kind of as a platform for the rest of the country. And I honestly think that you and I together, I think that since you've empowered me to get to fill in for Rush, I think we've put national pressure on the Seattle area. I think that's our work. So I want to thank you for that. And a personal note tonight, you know, while my family was out of town and I was working on this project, I got to do something that's sort of a guilty pleasure of mine. Do you have works of art, either books or movies, that you can watch again and again and again? I do, and I think most of us do. I didn't read the book this time because it's too long. I watched the made-for-TV movie, and it is not as good as the book. It's nowhere near as good as the book. It can't be. Nothing can ever be as good as the book. The book is Lonesome Dove, okay? And it is, for longtime listeners to the show, you remember this. Not only is it a book that the first time I read it cover to cover in about 2 days, and it's about a 700-page book. The moment I finished the book, I'll never forget, I was in bed at my friend Paul's house in Utah. I was staying the night with his family. He was kind enough to have me there. Paul worked for me, and so we saved money in a hotel room. I got to sleep downstairs in his guest room. I finished the book, and I turned it over to the very beginning, and I immediately started it again. And I consumed the book again in another 3 days. It's also a book that I shared with my dearest friend since seventh grade, Matthew, who consumes almost purely the Bible, Catholic theology, and great Russian novels. That's almost all he consumes. But I got him to read Lonesome Dove, and it blew his mind.
He said it was bigger than a Russian novel. It was a work of art. It had nothing to do with the West. I mean, the West was tangential to it. It's an epic story of epic men. I watched the movie again. I'll tell you what it is, the secret of this to me. It's the two men. It's Captain Call and Augustus. And if you don't know the story, these guys ended the Comanche reign in the Southwest. So they had a long career as Indian killers, right? A very non-PC topic. It happens that Larry McMurtry, who wrote the book, Lonesome Dove, and many others, it happens that he likes to write about the end of things. He likes to write about the end of eras. And of course, you know, the Indian Wars ending, well, the violent part of it ending, was an end of an era. Those two men and their friendship, based upon years of what they now see in the book, looking back, as slaughter, they don't necessarily regret it. They were, you know, building a country. But they are saddened because of something that was an unexpected consequence of what they did. They're proud of their work. They're Texas Rangers. They're two of the first Texas Rangers. They're saddened about something. Okay. Now, the book takes place in the beginning. It takes place in way South Texas, where Call and Augustus have become basically, they're basically cattle thieves. They cross the Rio Grande. They steal cows from Mexico. They bring them back over. And they do it more because they're bored than they need the money. They don't need the money. They're living in this small little town called Lonesome Dove. I don't want to get into the whole book. I want to get to the important parts. They decide, well, begrudgingly, Augustus doesn't want to. Captain Call wants to do this. They decide to go from South Texas all the way up to Montana to run this herd of stolen cows. Then to go start afresh in Montana. And they're seeking something that I don't think they know they're seeking. And so, of course, they go on this long, incredible trip, and there is a major villain in the book, a guy named Blue Duck. It's one of the first books I've read where they switch from points of view. So sometimes it's in one character's point of view, the other time it's in another. And it's written in this omnipotent point of view, right, so that you can shift easily. One of the characters dies, and you're with him when he dies. He's killed by this character named Blue Duck, who's one of the last real, real free Indians. And he hates Call, and he hates Augustus, and he wants to destroy them, and he gets to kill one of their buddies and gets to abduct a woman, and it's very much kind of a Western in that regard. But Blue Duck needs those men in a way that Call and Augustus don't recognize that they need him. They define him. He exists to confront them, and they have existed their entire life to confront him. They ultimately make it to the north. They make it up into Montana. And Augustus and this guy named P.I. decide to go out. P.E.A.P.I. decide to go out and scout. And they're set upon by a group of Native Americans in Montana. But they're young, kind of kids, Native Americans. But they succeed in putting an arrow through Augustus's leg. Augustus is unable to travel. He has confronted and found the thing he missed, and it kills him. Eventually, it takes his life. After a long time, and after refusing to have his leg cut off, and Call scream at him, you gotta let him take the leg, you won't let him take the leg. He found the thing that he missed. He missed the adversaries. Because it was the Comanches, the Great Plains Warriors, and they were fantastic riders. They were incredible tacticians in battle. And yeah, they were savage fighters, and so were the Texas Rangers. See, Call and Augustus, they miss their direct opposites. They miss men who rode to battle. They miss men who, against the odds of technology and against the odds of conquest and against the odds of numbers, fought to maintain their land, the Comanche land. They're adversaries who know in their hearts that they're really, truly alike. And they share that respect. Now, the great part of the book, the part that makes it almost like a Russian novel, is when he's dying. Augustus says to Call, I want you to do something for me. I want you, when I'm dead, to take my body back to Texas. See, Augustus never wanted to go north. And I imagine that Augustus is joking. But Call doesn't joke. It's just not in his nature. And so these two great warriors, one of them dead, and the other determined to keep a promise, they go back south. Call drags his buddy's body all the way back to Lonesome Dove because he said he would. And on the way, they confront Blue Duck. And Blue Duck takes his own life. Larry McMurtry writes about the end of things, the transition of things. Be a shame if we actually ended respect for a worthy adversary. This is the Todd Herman Show. We air every weekday, 3 to 6 p.m. I'll see you tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Be well, be strong, and be kind.